Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, March 13th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Clayton Collins, Director of Editorial Innovation. Technology puts marvels of productivity in our hands. Unmoderated, it can mislead us. It connects, but can isolate. It can save energy, but also be a voracious user of resources. What should guide its use? In Israel, signs are emerging of over-reliance on high-tech monitoring as a factor in the security breach of October 7th, 2023. On TikTok, a man with a Haiti-registered social media account earned social media stardom, only to lose out to others better positioned to profit from his creative enterprise. Thanks to algorithms and laws, responsibility matters. So too does fairness. Today's first story is titled "Columbia Protester Arrest Ignites Free Speech Tug of War." Less than a week after immigration officials in New York arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian student activist and a green card holder, much remains unclear about the government's specific accusations against him. The Trump administration appears to be entering uncharted legal waters as the government seeks to define and deport individuals whom it sees as threats. Some immigration advocates are wary of government retaliation against First Amendment-protected speech. Others see Mr. Khalil's case as part of a broader crackdown on dissent. As with many aspects of this administration, it's pushing the law to the limit, says Gabriel Chin, an immigration law scholar at the University of California Davis School of Law. By Sarah Matusek, Henry Gass, and Nate Englehart. The college campus tumult over Israel's war in Gaza has collided with the United States' immigration debate. The Trump administration's framing of its detention of a Palestinian student activist as a defense against rising anti-Semitism is a move that launches, in effect, a new round of free speech tug-of-war. Nearly a week after immigration officials arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a green card holder living in New York, there are still no formal charges against him outside of immigration court. President Donald Trump has called the Palestinian activist a, quote, radical foreign pro-Hamas student, and the first arrest of many to come. Immigrant advocates and many legal experts have decried Mr. Khalil's detention as a possibly unconstitutional violation of free speech. They also warn of the tactic's potential chilling effect on other immigrants and Americans alike. Beyond the issues of civil liberties is the seemingly ascendant role of the Secretary of State. The provision of immigration law affords the office a specific deportation power, which the Trump administration is invoking now, according to an immigration court document obtained by the Washington Post. Immigration experts say the country may be entering uncharted legal waters as the government seeks new ways to identify and deport people it considers threats to American foreign policy. Like a lot of things that this administration is doing, it's pushing the law to the limit, says Gabriel Chin, an immigration law scholar at the University of California Davis School of Law. It's unusual, at least since the McCarthy era, he adds, to attempt to deport immigrants for controversial political activity. where and when the latest tensions began. On October 7th, 2023, a Hamas-led attack killed around 1,200 people in Israel and took 251 hostages. Israel retaliated with an air and ground campaign that has killed at least 48,500 people, according to the local health authority. Protests over the war have roiled colleges across the U.S., including Columbia University in New York. Masked demonstrators occupied parts of campus and disrupted classes. In the following months, Mr. Trump began discussing student visa revocations on the campaign trail and then set the stage on day one of his new administration, January 20th, 2025. That day, he signed an executive order vowing protection of U.S. citizens from immigrants who intend to commit terrorist attacks, threaten our national security, espouse hateful ideology. Also, in January, he reaffirmed a policy introduced in his first term to combat anti-Semitism vigorously, including through prosecution and deportation. A Palestinian from Syria, Mr. Khalil, is a recent Columbia graduate student who has had a green card, also known as a permanent resident card. That means he has been authorized to live and work in the U.S. with a path to citizenship. Unlike migrants seeking to enter the U.S., immigrants who are in the country are entitled to due process in removal proceedings. Last year, he became a public face of student-led protests against Israel's war in Gaza. "It's time for us to show that, yes, we want to be visible," he told the press in April, standing before a tent encampment. "The university should do something about what we're asking. They should stop investing in this genocide." The New York Times reports that Mr. Khalil described his role as a negotiator and spokesperson for a pro-Palestinian group called Columbia University Apartheid Divest. The group drew scrutiny this past summer for what appears to be a now deleted Instagram post in support of Bengali protesters. Local news reported the post as saying, "We are Westerners fighting for the total eradication of Western civilization." Whether Mr. Khalil was involved in the post is unknown. A law firm representing him did not respond to a request for clarification. Federal immigration officials arrested Mr. Khalil at his university housing Saturday, according to a court document. They first told him his detention was due to his student visa having been revoked by the State Department, according to the filing. But after they were shown documentation that he was a lawful permanent resident, the agents arrested him anyway, saying that his green card had also been revoked, the document said. Mr. Khalil was transferred from New York to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, ICE, custody in Louisiana. In a statement through a lawyer, the activist's pregnant wife, a U.S. citizen, asked the public for support. "I need your help to bring Mahmoud home," she said. On Sunday, Mr. Khalil's counsel filed a habeas petition, claiming his detention is unlawful in federal court. Judge Jesse Furman temporarily barred the government from deporting Mr. Khalil, pending further proceedings in the Southern District of New York. In court Wednesday, counsel for the government said it wanted to move the case out of New York. Mr. Khalil's legal team said it hasn't been able to reach its client since his transfer to Louisiana over the weekend. Immigrants, including green card holders, can be deported for a variety of reasons. It does not appear that the government has filed any criminal charges against Mr. Khalil. he has not been accused of contacting Hamas. However, the government appears to be relying on a part of immigration law that permits certain input from the Secretary of State. An immigrant can be deported if the secretary determines that they would have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the country. The Secretary of State then notifies the Department of Homeland Security, which can initiate deportation charges. A spokesperson for the State Department referred to that part of immigration law without elaboration. In response to questions from the Monitor about Mr. Khalil's case and visa revocation plans. The day after the arrest, Secretary Marco Rubio said on the social platform X, "We will be revoking the visas and/or green cards of Hamas supporters in America so they can be deported." White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt has accused Mr. Khalil of organizing group protests that not only disrupted college campus classes and harassed Jewish American students, but also made them feel unsafe on their own college campus. Mr. Khalil has an initial immigration court date in Louisiana on March 27th, according to his notice to appear, which he refused to sign. His is now among the more than 3.7 million pending cases in immigration court. A matter of dissent. The government's arrest of Mr. Khalil has drawn praise from its MAGA base while dividing the Jewish community. The Anti-Defamation League praised the administration and said on X that any deportation or revocation of legal status must be carried out with required due process protections. Anyone in the U.S. with a visa or green card is a guest, and if they're going to call for terroristic activity, they need to leave, says Laura Reese, director of the Border Security and Immigration Center at the Heritage Foundation. Despite logistical limits to Mr. Trump's promised mass deportation so far, inciting violence and support for terrorism is good grounds for using ICE resources, says Ms. Reese, an immigration official during the first Trump term. Meanwhile, solidarity protests supporting Mr. Khalil have cropped up in California, Illinois, and New York, while a petition demanding his release has garnered more than 2.9 million signatures. In Congress, 14 Democrats signed a letter decrying the arrest as an act of anti-Palestinian racism, along with being a lawless abuse of power and political repression, threatening all Americans. At the New York Immigration Coalition, Murad Awadeh, president and CEO, called Mr. Khalil's targeting a blatantly unconstitutional act. In a statement, he also appealed to local elected officials to intervene. The U.S. has a long history of ideological exclusion and deportation, says Julia Rose Kraut, author of The Threat of Dissent, A History of Ideological Exclusion and Deportation in the United States. While the targets have changed over time, the use of ideological exclusion and deportation as tools of political repression have not, she says. The legal historian points to the McCarthy era of the 1950s that targeted communists, real and suspected. While 231 people were deported on ideological grounds between 1950 and 1956, she says, this strategy was less about numbers and more about fear. It's unclear how many foreign-born students the current administration will seek to deport on political grounds. Even if limited, says Professor Chin, the effort could still be hugely symbolic and possibly quite effective at stifling dissent. He raises the question of whether the government will have to justify its conclusion, in this case, why it sees Mr. Khalil as a potential source of, quote, adverse foreign policy consequences. On foreign policy, however, the Supreme Court has said that a very large amount of deference should be given to the administration, says George Fishman, senior legal fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. At the same time, determining deportability through the Secretary of State or on terrorism engagement grounds has been largely untested in federal courts, he says. Others are wary of government retaliation against First Amendment-protected speech. Conflating pro-terrorist, anti-Semitic, and anti-American activity is an incredibly dangerous step to take, writes legal scholar Steve Vladek in his newsletter. While the first may be enough to deport a green card holder, he says, the second and third by themselves shouldn't. Part of a broader crackdown. As legal questions swirl, Mr. Khalil's case emerges as a part of a broader crackdown. The Secretary of State is launching an artificial intelligence-powered effort to cancel the visas of those who appear to support Hamas or other groups designated as terrorist organizations, reports Axios, citing unnamed senior officials. Reuters reports that the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee is aware of a number of Palestinian students who've had visas revoked since Mr. Trump returned to office. The State Department did not directly address requests for confirmation of either report. Beyond people, Washington is also targeting institutions. Last week, the Trump administration announced the cancellation of some $400 million in federal grants to Columbia University, citing inaction on harassment of Jewish students. This week, the Department of Education said it sent letters to Columbia and 59 other higher education institutions warning them to protect Jewish students or face potential enforcement actions. The White House has continued to foreshadow more student arrests. Columbia University has been given the names of other individuals who have engaged in pro-Hamas activity, and they are refusing to help Homeland Security identify those individuals on campus, said Press Secretary Ms. Leavitt on Tuesday. The university did not respond to a request for comment. The president, she said, is not going to tolerate that. Next story. Education department cut by half. Will Trump still try to shut it down? About half of the employees at the U.S. Department of Education were placed on administrative leave or took a buyout March 11th. The cuts reflect a commitment to efficiency, accountability, and ensuring that resources are directed where they matter most to students, parents, and teachers, said Secretary of Education Linda McMahon in a statement. Will an outright effort to shut it down follow? That would take an act of Congress. It's also unclear what effect doing so would have on the students who rely on extra service from federal funding or financial aid for higher education. Without agency oversight, our economy and workforce will suffer, and this will damage our economy for generations to come, says Kerry Rodriguez, co-founder of the National Parents Union. By Jackie Valley and Troy Aiden Sambahon. President Donald Trump's vow to dismantle the Education Department moved closer to fruition on March 11th. About half of the department's roughly 4,100 employees were placed on administrative leave or took a buyout, the department said. The action puts conservatives' years-long desire to quash what they perceive as federal influence over the United States schools, colleges, and universities a step closer to realization. It also fulfills a campaign pledge from Mr. Trump, though many questions remain. The first one, will the halving of the department be followed by an outright effort to shut it down entirely? It would take an act of Congress to close the 45-year-old agency. It's also unclear the ripple effect doing so would have on the most vulnerable students who rely on extra services from federal funding or financial aid for higher education. The Education Department serves a variety of functions, such as collecting data, monitoring student achievement, helping low-income students and students with disabilities, and investigating civil rights violations, among other responsibilities. At the college level, the department administers $1.5 trillion in student loans, Pell Grants aimed at helping low-income students, as well as FAFSA, the financial aid system used by a majority of students and their families to pay for college. The Department of Education will continue to deliver on all programs mandated by law, including formula funding, student loans, Pell Grants, funding for special needs students, and competitive grant making, the press release said. Today's reduction in force reflects the Department of Education's commitment to efficiency, accountability, and ensuring that resources are directed where they matter most to students, parents, and teachers, said Secretary of Education Linda McMahon in the statement. The president and his allies haven't been shy about their disdain for the Education Department. Project 2025, the conservative blueprint for reforming the United States, has called for the outright elimination of the agency. Support has ramped up in Congress, especially within the U.S. House of Representatives. House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, indicated earlier this month that they are at least open to the conversation. Democratic lawmakers in the U.S. Senate, however, would likely filibuster any such legislation. I think that is an idea whose time has come, Mr. Johnson said during a press briefing. However, any effort to close the department entirely would face a more difficult road in the Senate, where Democratic votes would be needed to overcome a filibuster. I think a lot of people forget what education was like 50 or 60 years ago before the Department of Education. Children who were blind, deaf, and had Down syndrome weren't given access to classrooms. Children with autism were often institutionalized instead of going to school, says Carrie Rodriguez, co-founder of the National Parents Union. We had states that had to be sued and children who had to be walked into classrooms by federal marshals in order to integrate into the nation's classrooms. That's what happened before we had federal oversight over education. Without the accountability function of the Education Department, our economy and workforce will suffer, and this will damage our economy for generations to come, Ms. Rodriguez adds. The coalescing of Republican support around the issue signals the power Mr. Trump wields in the political arena. Legislation filed in prior congressional sessions pertaining to the abolition or restructuring of the Education Department never gained much traction. Now supporters are leaning into recent national test results showing broad declines in students' reading and math skills to bolster their case for slashing the department. Former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who served under the first Trump administration, minced no words in a column penned for the Free Press. She's described the Education Department as a middleman. It shuffles money around, adds unnecessary requirements and political agendas via its grants, and then passes the buck when it comes time to assess if any of that adds value, Ms. DeVos wrote. Even so, the mission appears equally ideologically driven. Conservatives have railed against a woke agenda they allege is infiltrating public schools. In turn, Mr. Trump has signed executive orders aimed at stopping lessons about systemic racism, gender transition care for minors, and transgender athletes from competing in women's sports. Meanwhile, an executive order signed by President Trump, titled Ending Radical Indoctrination in K-12 Schooling, also revives the 1776 Commission to promote patriotic education. Shortly before leaving office in January 2021, Mr. Trump had established the 1776 Commission in November 2020. When former President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, he promptly discontinued it. Critics argue the Educational Department cutbacks are less about improving student outcomes and more about instituting a conservative agenda. After all, the vast majority of education decisions are made at the local and state level, which also contribute about 90% of public school funding. This elimination of the Department of Education is part of a larger attempt to significantly scale down the federal investments in public education. This is in the Project 2025 playbook, says Blair Wriston, Senior Government Affairs Manager at nonprofit Ed Trust. The downstream fights from these massive cuts to education are going to create a system of winners and losers. Students of color, rural students, and low-income students are the ones who are going to suffer under these attacks on public education. Plus, Mr. Trump has championed the idea of school choice. He has said that in her role, Secretary McMahon would help spread the concept across all states. If that goal involves the use of federal funds for voucher-style programs, it flies in the face of his purported desire to reduce the federal government's role in education. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. Saudi leader parlays oil wealth into global diplomatic clout. Saudi ruler Mohammed bin Salman has used his country's oil wealth to build its international clout in diplomacy, tech, and global sport. By Ned Temko, London. This week, all eyes have been on talks that President Donald Trump portrays as a high-stakes diplomatic card game, with peace in Ukraine as the prize. Yet, no matter how that drama ends, there is already one clear winner, the owner of the card table. Saudi Arabia, a country that is largely made up of desert, has fewer than 40 million people, and boasts a middling military with no nuclear arms, may be emerging as the 21st century's most improbable superpower. For the brashly ambitious 39-year-old running the country, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, represents a political revival no less dramatic than Mr. Trump's. The latest sign of his burgeoning clout? The role that Saudi Arabia has played as host of the Americans' successive meetings with Russian and Ukrainian negotiators. MBS stands to benefit further from close ties with Mr. Trump, who has reportedly chosen Saudi Arabia for his first foreign trip since regaining the White House. But the Saudi leader has been busy building relationships with other centers of power and influence in the past few years, too. They range from China, Russia, and India to innovative artificial intelligence, high-tech developers, and international sports leagues. while he will be keen to forge the closest possible ties with Mr. Trump, especially on military and security issues, their interests could diverge when it comes to the Crown Prince's overtures to U.S. rivals and competitors. How they navigate these differences could influence a number of issues, from peace in Ukraine to the future of Gaza, and even Mr. Trump's effort to reshape U.S. relations with Russia and China. That's because, unlike Ukraine's president, who Mr. Trump recently rebuked for not having the cards in peace talks, MBS does have the cards. His ace lies beneath the Saudi desert, the largest oil reserves in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia is the world's top oil exporter. That gives the kingdom significant influence over customers, including China, which has become its leading trade partner. Saudi oil also gives the Crown Prince sway over the global supply of crude and its price. That is a lever that he has pulled to Russian President Vladimir Putin's advantage since the invasion of Ukraine. He has kept production down and world prices up, boosting the Kremlin's profits from its own oil exports. Saudi oil exports still bring in well over $200 billion a year, giving MBS virtually unlimited cash to spend on his dream of retooling Saudi Arabia as a major world power. It is a complex vision. The unalloyed upside for a country where over half the population is under 30 years old has been his determination to modernize the kingdom. Hardline Muslim clerics and their religious police have been sidelined. Movie theaters have opened for the first time. Some restrictions on women have been loosened. They are now allowed to drive and are entering the workforce in greater numbers and at higher levels. Still, there has been no loosening of political control. Overt criticism of Crown Prince Mohammed's rule or a call for greater liberalization can still land you in jail, or worse. In 2018, dissident Saudi journalist and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered. A CIA report concluded that MBS sanctioned that crime. Yet, despite credible allegations of continuing serious human rights violations, a leader denounced as a pariah after Mr. Khashoggi's death is now widely wooed well beyond America's borders. He has drawn closer to China and to Russia as a fellow oil producer. He has been welcomed into the BRICS economic coalition of countries in the global south. And he is also a major player on two international policy fronts where his interests and Washington's could clash. The first is artificial intelligence and technology, a centerpiece of Crown Prince Mohammed's vision of a post-oil economy. He has earmarked billions of dollars to attract experts, researchers, and entrepreneurs in AI to visit, teach, invest, and set up shop in Saudi Arabia. U.S. officials are worried that this initiative could transform the kingdom into a sanctions-busting backdoor for China as Beijing seeks top-flight technology. The second potential point of friction is the Middle East, where Saudi Arabia, as the wealthiest and most influential Arab Muslim country, would appear to be a critical part of any workable plan to rebuild Gaza. Mr. Trump will rightly anticipate that an early visit to Saudi Arabia will be a meeting of friends with wide scope for common ground. On security, there's an obvious win-win. The prospect of major new purchases of U.S. arms which the Saudis need in return for billions of dollars. But Gaza, where Donald Trump has envisioned an international tourist paradise with no Palestinian residents, could prove a lot trickier. That is especially true if Mr. Trump wants to build on his first administration's main diplomatic achievement, the Abraham Accords between Israel and several Arab states, by bringing Saudi Arabia into the fold. The U.S. president has indicated support for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's intention of hitting Hamas even harder, even suggesting the relocation of the entire Palestinian population to nearby Arab states. That, MBS has made clear, is a non-starter, and he can back up his position with muscle. His country's oil wealth, technology initiatives, regional influence, and increasingly strong relations with other major powers. MBS has cards to play. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the print disabled. Next story. Democrats wrestle with truly abhorrent options. Shut down government or enable Trump. A government shutdown could happen March 14th after the House passed a Republican bill to fund the government. Senate Democrats face few good options. By Cameron Joseph, Washington. Senate Democrats are in a no-win situation. With less than 2 days until a potential federal government shutdown, they are facing two options. Either back a Republican plan to keep the government open and give away their first bit of leverage since President Donald Trump took office, or force a shutdown that many worry would only lead to deeper cuts to the federal workforce. You have two things that are truly abhorrent. When you get to that level, it's hard to rank one versus the other. That's why it's a hard decision, says Democratic Senator John Hickenlooper of Colorado. They're both such great evils. House Republicans passed a bill on Tuesday that would keep the government open through September while handing more power to President Trump to shift around funds, cutting real domestic spending, and punishing the District of Columbia by forcing the city to make deep spending cuts, even though its budget is funded by local taxpayer money. Democrats are outraged at the provisions and are facing fierce demands from their base to do something, anything, to stand up to Mr. Trump as he and billionaire Elon Musk slash the government workforce. But if they force a shutdown starting at 12:01 a.m. Saturday morning, many worry it will backfire. The Trump administration will be in charge of implementing that shutdown, which means it will determine which workers are essential and must keep working for no pay, and which can be sent home. And as the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, cuts a wide swath through the federal workforce, Democrats worry that could make it even easier for the administration to fire people while putting the blame on them. While Republicans have often leveraged government shutdowns or the threat of them to extract major policy wins over the past decade plus, Democrats, as the more pro-government party, have been far more reluctant to do so. The lone exception came early in Mr. Trump's first term when Democrats triggered a brief shutdown over immigration issues before quickly folding. But this time it's unclear which step would better protect government employees and the work they do. The Trump administration is already slashing programs and staff left and right, and this is one of the few moments where Democrats have any real power. The showdown comes as the Trump administration continues its widespread and potentially illegal evisceration of the federal government. Even as Senate Democrats were debating the least terrible path forward, the Department of Education announced it was laying off about half of its workforce, 1,300 employees, the latest in a series of deep government cuts not authorized by Congress. So far, the Trump administration, aided by Mr. Musk's Doge team, has laid off tens of thousands of government workers across various agencies and is signaling even deeper cuts to come. Democrats emerged from the latest in a series of long, tense lunch meetings on Wednesday, from which raised voices could be heard in the halls with a simulacrum of a strategy. They demand a vote on extending government funding at current levels for 1 month, giving appropriators time to work out a longer extension. Republicans do not have the votes in the Senate to pass the Republican House bill, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Wednesday afternoon on the Senate floor. But Democrats' measure appears to be more of a face-saving effort than one that could actually work. If enough Democrats vote to consider the House bill, and their amendment then fails, as seems likely, Republicans can then pass it without Democratic votes. Both sides expect that in the end, Democrats are more likely than not to allow the Republicans' bill to pass. Senate Republicans have scheduled a procedural vote for Friday. They will likely need 8 Senate Democrats to vote with them to move forward. As the deadline approached, some Democrats, who often back bipartisan measures, signaled they're not interested in helping out. Senator Hickenlooper told the Monitor Wednesday afternoon that he thought both options risked making it easier for President Trump and Mr. Musk to drive their agenda of slashing the federal workforce. But he announced on social media that evening that opposing the GOP bill and risking a government shutdown was the least bad option. Virginia Senator Mark Warner, one of the Senate's more moderate and bipartisan members, came to the same conclusion. Senator Warner also represents a state with a high number of federal government workers and has long been a supporter of Washington, D.C., just over the river from his state. On Thursday morning, he posted a video declaring that he wouldn't vote to allow the GOP plan to proceed, saying it was a gratuitous and mean-spirited attack on D.C. and would cause damage to neighboring Virginia. He also said he would refuse to turn over the keys with no restraint to Trump and Musk. The only Democrat who has publicly pledged to vote for the GOP plan is Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman. Despite his unhappiness with some of the GOP provisions of the bill, he says a shutdown would hurt Americans more and blow up in Democrats' faces politically. He predicted it won't take long before Democrats are begging to reopen the government. House Democrats made the opposition calculation. All but one Democrat voted against the GOP passed plan earlier in the week. Many expressed frustration that their Senate counterparts weren't showing the same collective spine. New York Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez told the Monitor, "I sure hope they don't," when asked how she wanted Senate Democrats to vote on the GOP plan. "This creates a massive slush fund for Donald Trump and Elon Musk," she says. "I think it is irresponsible. It removes any of the guardrails around ensuring that these funds that are appropriated are spent responsibly. I don't think it's right." It's not just progressives like Representative Ocasio-Cortez who want their Senate colleagues to oppose the bill. People with 2-year terms showed some courage. Let's see what people with 6-year terms will do, Representative Scott Peters, a moderate Democrat from California, told the Monitor as he exited the House floor after the vote. But House Democrats' choice to vote against the GOP bill was more theoretical. If Senate Democrats follow through, it will actually trigger a government shutdown. And the clock is ticking. We never want to have a shutdown, obviously. It's not the preferred option, says centrist Michigan Democratic Senator Gary Peters. But we've got two bad options right now. Next story. In Kansas, the Shawnee vie for control of their history. A controversy in Kansas illustrates the dark history of U.S. Indian boarding schools. Can indigenous peoples like the Shawnee control their story? By Devin Haney and Alfredo Sosa. Fairway, Kansas. Chief Ben Barnes of the Shawnee tribe based in Miami, Oklahoma, spends a lot of time thinking about Kansas. There, in a small town called Fairway, three red brick buildings sit aging on land once allotted to his tribe. These federal-style structures are what remain of what was once called the Shawnee Indian Manual Labor Boarding School. It was among the earliest of a federally supported system of residential schools intended to assimilate indigenous children into American culture and force them to leave their own behind. Like Mr. Barnes, many members of the Shawnee tribe can trace their ancestry to those who once lived in what he calls a child work camp. Today, the site is owned by the Kansas Historical Society, a state agency. Now called the Shawnee Indian Mission State Historic Site, it is run by officials in the city of Fairway, with funding help from a local foundation. These partners help run a decades-old museum in one of the 19th-century-era buildings. 5 years ago, Mr. Barnes began to cooperate with the Kansas Historical Society, and later he accepted a seat on the local foundation's board as officials were planning a significant renovation and expansion. Together, each group was eager to transform the site. They all wanted to build a state-of-the-art museum and tell the story of the boarding school better. The Shawnee would play a significant part throughout this process and have a permanent role. But this enthusiastic cooperation eventually turned into an abyss of mistrust. Until recently, the history of U.S. boarding schools for indigenous children has mostly been forgotten. But here in Kansas and other places where such school buildings still stand, there's momentum to delve more deeply into this dark past, dark part of America's past. Mr. Barnes, like other Native leaders around the country, has begun to learn details about his ancestors that he hadn't known before. When historians came in to study the Shawnee Indian Manual Labor Boarding School's archives, their findings made his relatives of older generations come alive for him in important and complicated ways. And the more he learned, the more he found he could not share the vision the other parties had for commemorating a common past. For very practical reasons, plans for the site aimed to include opportunities to raise awareness and much-needed funds. And since the site was already a National Historic Landmark for a number of reasons, the other partners wanted to expand the kinds of civic events it hosted, such as yoga classes, concerts, a fall festival, and Christmas tree sales. A large pavilion for these activities was being considered. These ideas appalled Mr. Barnes. Then he discovered there were YouTube clips posted by local paranormal investigators who had rented space. They were holding a séance on the site, speculating whether they were communicating with spirits of indigenous children. On top of that, he had concerns about the overall upkeep at the site, and he began to grow concerned about the conditions of the buildings. Mr. Barnes soon resigned from the foundation's board and withdrew Shawnee participation from the project. Today, he is urging Kansas state legislators to transfer ownership of this site to his tribe, a measure lawmakers are currently considering. His own plan is to turn all three buildings into a museum that would address all chapters of the mission's history. The darkest chapter, the history of the boarding school era, would be told from a tribal perspective. We have a responsibility. It's not just honoring the dead, but we have to speak on their behalf, take care of their concerns while they're on the other side and we're here, Mr. Barnes says. I find myself having to do that with these people that went to the mission, whether they survived or not. Yes, the majority survived, but none of them really survived. The uncomfortable truths of U.S. and Native American history. Chief Barnes also spends a lot of time thinking about Dave Duchesne. He was Mr. Barnes's great-great-great-grandfather. He had a son, Peter Duchesne, the chief's great-great-grandfather. Historians had been delving deeper into the former boarding school's records. One of them sent Mr. Barnes what he'd found about the Duchesnes. In the 1850s, he found Peter Duchesne was repeatedly escaping from the boarding school. Each time the missionaries who ran the residential school on Shawnee Indian land would go out to retrieve him, knowing he usually just went back home, but the boy's father eventually told them to stop. He would take care of the problem himself. When Peter ran away again, his father tied his son's hands to a horse's tail and dragged him back to the mission. Peter never ran away again. The story has shaken Mr. Barnes. I saw the names and, like, man, this is my people, says Mr. Barnes, who simply recognized them from family trees. So that was pretty heavy to read about your people. He had to wrestle with his own ambivalence. I saw the story through the kids' eyes at first. What that betrayal must have felt like, he says. It took some time to really digest what the perspective of the father must have been. It's also difficult to digest the larger history of American policy governing boarding schools for indigenous children. For the Shawnee, the history of these policies is indeed a dark history and part of the American story, long ignored. Between 1819 and 1969, about 400 federally funded boarding schools operated nationwide, according to a landmark 2024 report by the U.S. Department of the Interior. At least 18,600 indigenous children attended these schools, and at least 973 died while living there, the study found, some of them buried in unmarked graves. Though it is uncomfortable to learn that the country you love is capable of committing such acts, the first step to justice is acknowledging these painful truths and gaining a full understanding of their impacts so that we can unravel the threads of trauma and injustice that linger, wrote former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, revealing that her maternal grandparents and great-grandfather had been forcibly separated from their families and culture. Acknowledging such painful truths, too, is the first step to healing. After the report was released, she helped lead a 12-city tour of healing, in which Native American peoples could publicly share with the U.S. government such threads of trauma inflicted for almost two centuries. On July 9, 2022, Chief Barnes was among the first to speak at the federally sponsored Road to Healing Tour organized by former Interior Secretary Haaland. The purpose of her department's landmark study on Americans' Indian boarding schools, she said, was to take the first step to justice by acknowledging painful truths. It was also a first step to healing, she believed. Mr. Barnes has spent a significant part of his life trying to revive the Shawnee language and religious practices. He's among just a few who can still speak some Shawnee. So when he stood before the audience at Riverside Indian School in Anadarko, Oklahoma, the first stop on the government's Road to Healing tour, he spoke in his native tongue to open his address before switching to English. The legacy of boarding schools and removal from families is real, present, and existential, he said. Coming just to Riverside and other schools is not going to be enough. There needs to be a national system for them to bear testimony and send testimonies in it. That needs to be the norm, because for a lot of our people, they don't want to be anywhere close to the site of their rape. And I apologize for that word. I apologize for that word, but that's what it was. That makes healing difficult, especially after centuries of violence in a country with an official policy of cultural erasure. The story of the former Indian Manual Labor Boarding School in Kansas is not just central to Shawnee history, he argues. It is central to America's, woven into the fabric of a nation built on the dispossession of indigenous peoples. That is why he is battling for his people to control the National Historic Landmark site in Fairway, where the school's three buildings still bear the dark history of the Shawnee in Kansas. We understand how a monument can become sacred, but for whatever reason, we find difficulty that Shawnee people can find this place sacred, Mr. Barnes says. What makes it sacred? The fact that it still stands makes it sacred. The fact that those stories need to be told makes it sacred. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, March 13th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.